They're the sisters, referring to their brother Lazarus who is ill. Isn't it a wonderful thing? We should go around our relationships and our familial responsibilities and think of ourselves as the one whom Jesus loved, that you might have power, together with all the saints, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of God. In other words, that you might be mature. The implication is you can't be mature unless you experience for yourself more and more fully that you are loved by God.
Today on the Song Time broadcast, we'll continue our study in the Gospel of John. This message from Dr. D.A. Carson will tell us the story of Lazarus, a friend of Jesus whom he raised from the dead. Speaking of friendship, we're also going to hear from Trillia Newbell, a children's author who's written an amazing book on the subject of friendship and our relationship with Jesus. The many voices are coming together for that one message. I'm your host, Adam Miller. You're listening to Song Time Radio. One of the things that I have found really important for us to focus on when we're thinking about and in our sort of adult conversations, what is the gospel and why is it important and how does it affect us on our own personal level, is the realization that we have all around us little ones that are learning from us and oftentimes getting miscues because we're not taking the time to stop, pause, and teach them the things that are most central to our hearts. And so it's become sort of an emphasis that we've had on the broadcast for a number of years now to really focus on how we communicate the gospel to the next generation. And that is why I'm so excited and thrilled to be joined today by Trillia Newbell, who is the author of a children's book called Jesus and the Gift of Friendship. I've read through this, and honestly, it was the shortest read I've done all year, but it is still a remarkable book that captures so many complex truths and makes them simple for the next generation. So, Trillia, thank you so much for being a part of the many voices for that one message.
Thank you. That's encouraging.
Why don't you get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself? This isn't obviously your only foray into writing. It's not only a children's book, but you've written a lot of different books. So tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and your passion for the gospel.
Yes. Well, I'll start with the passion for the gospel. I became a Christian at the age of 22, and so someone shared the gospel with me, and their faithfulness and bravery, if you may, and boldness and love for me led me to the Lord. So I'm so grateful for the gospel. I remember reading Ephesians 2 for the first time and it clicking, for by grace you've been saved through faith. This is a gift no one can boast. And so that kind of message I hadn't heard before, that you didn't earn God's favor, but it was a free gift. I had no idea. I have always earned things, right? And so the gospel is very important and central to what I do and why I'm doing what I'm doing. So I became a Christian at the age of 22. I'm from Tennessee. I have two teenagers, and I love my teenagers. If I could change the narrative on teenagers, I would do that. But that's a whole nother podcast. and I've been married for 20 years. And I write. I've been writing for as long as I can remember. Even in high school, I had a interest in writing, but I wrote for a paper as a freelance journalist, and then I've done a lot of writing, and my first book, I think, was in 2014. I can't actually remember, which is funny, but since 2012, I know I've been writing books or working on writing books, and it's a joy and a delight to get to do it.
Now, writing books is one thing, you know, because you can express your thoughts in a very mature manner, but taking those same thoughts and really kind of honing them and crafting them for a child is a different task altogether. And it's why there are very few really well-accomplished child book writers out there that can really do it well. So what is it that caused you to want to do this book for children?
You know, it's actually started in a Sunday school. So I was doing children's ministry, and I did children's ministry in my old church before we moved for 10 years. And I never thought about writing a kid's book. It never dawned on me that I would be writing children's books. And then I did a lesson at my current church for the kids, gosh, some eight years ago or so, on the topic of the Imago Dei, the image of God, and the beauty and diversity of the church, and their response and their delight in learning is what prompted me to write. And so I thought, are there other parents who could benefit from this information just trimmed down a bit so a child might understand it? And that's actually, it was from a local church context. I was serving my local church, had written something because I couldn't find it exactly the way I wanted it. And I thought, if this could translate into a picture book, a kid's book, I want to try. And a publisher took a chance on it, and you know, the rest is history, as they say. But you are right. It is a different type of writing to write for children and to take big concepts. I said the Imago Dei, which is the image of God. And how do you take that big concept and make it one word? Because mm-hmm. that's what you have to do. And there's books after books on just that idea. That's in Genesis, right? Books after books. But that is what's also wonderful about writing kids' books, is that you have to know what you believe, and it kind of refines what you believe, and it helps you put language to it in such a way that not only I have received so many notes from adults who are reading the kids' books and they are benefiting, which is so encouraging to me, and it just build my faith. But yeah, there's something about it that helps you gain that childlike faith that we see in the scriptures talked about.
Yeah. I'm a pastor, and here in New England on Cape Cod, and I have my small congregation, but what I look forward to every week is actually teaching the little children. We have a children's ministry in the midweek, and I just adore their attention to details, their desire to learn, and their ability to respond and react and actually comprehend the things that I'm teaching. If I could have my choice, I'd probably choose the little kids over the adults on Sunday morning. But I think it was actually Charles Ryrie, who is a theologian from another generation, that said, and it was so memorable to me, he says, if you can't preach to the oldest people in your congregation and the youngest people in your congregation, you really have no part preaching to anyone in the middle. And I think that mm-hmm. there's something special there, is really understanding these concepts that you can boil it down to the youngest person, but also expound on it for the oldest person. It really does show how valuable this is. But sometimes we overlook the little kids in our congregation. We don't think that they're picking these ideas up, and that's to our own detriment.
Oh, yes, that's true. They learn so much, and they are listening. I mean, if you're a parent, you've probably seen your child mimic you, and you think, oh, I say that, or I do that. Where'd you pick that up? They are constantly learning and trying to interpret the world around them. And one of the things that I work at Moody Publishers, and I helped develop a line of Bible studies for kids. And one of the things that I often say is, if kids can learn geometry, they can learn the Bible. And so often I don't know why, but we think for Bible learning, we don't go to the hard concepts or talk about the tough things. But they're always learning something hard. If they can learn algebra and geometry and conjugations, we can teach them the Bible. And so that is my hope in even writing. I try to write in a way that is simple enough for them to understand, but still will challenge them to think and ask questions. And the parent can help, or the guardian can help fill in any blanks that might be there. But yes, children learn. And we should not take them for granted, and or take it for granted that they are learning.
We've been talking with Trillia Newbell. Her book is for little children, and it's called Jesus and the Gift of Friendship. Over the past couple of years, I've grown with an understanding of the importance of reaching the next generation. And we've already had many guests from John Nielsen talking about his devotional for teens and others already this year. And I think this is going to become an emphasis going forward of thinking about how to reach the next generation with the gospel of Christ. This is a great storybook for little children. And it's also something that you as an adult are going to want to read to them over and over again. I guarantee it. Find out more information about Trillia Newbell and her book, Jesus and the Gift of Friendship, by giving us a call. It's 508-362-7070. That's 508-362-7070. Well, today as we continue our study in the Gospel of John, this week we're going to be talking about Jesus as the resurrection and the life. It happens in the middle of a story of Jesus meeting some of his friends, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. In today's message, Dr. D.A. Carson takes us to the introduction to this amazing story that shows us a little bit about how God likes to subvert our expectations. Here is D.A. Carson.
Now, a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. And then he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." This is the word of the Lord. So often God surprises us. Moses thought so. As a young man, he thought he'd bring about revolution. He ended up on the backside of a desert for the next half century or so. And finally, when God called him, Moses was already 80 years old. Time to retire and slow down. Besides, Moses didn't have any gift of speech. He wasn't comfortable. It was a bit surprising that God would call in an 80-year-old. Mind you, I have more and more sympathy for 80-year-olds, I have to say. Habakkuk thought it was a bit surprising, too. God is surprising. He could understand how God could use a regional superpower to chasten his covenant people because of their idolatry. What he didn't understand was how God could use a regional superpower which on every graph was socially more corrupt, was morally more corroded, was more violent, was more destitute of grace and godliness than the Israelite people that they were sent to chasten. How could God do that? Paul thought that God was a bit surprising. I mean, he could pray for people and they would be healed. He saw the hand of God's power in the alleviation of illness. Now he has this thorn in the flesh, a messenger from Satan to torment him, and he prays and God says, "I'm not going to do it. I'll give you grace instead," which initially didn't satisfy Paul at all. He prayed diligently, setting aside repeated times for intercessory prayer until Paul learned, "My grace is sufficient for you." So often God surprises us. And then, of course, there's Abraham, promised this son who finally showed up, and then God tells Abraham to slaughter him. But one of the things that is most striking about the gospel is that at its heart, it is a gospel of surprises. Who amongst the apostles anticipated that God would redeem his people by sending his son to die for them by taking their place? Who expected Jesus to rise from the dead? Not the women who went to the grave. They had ointment to pour on his body. Not the apostles. They were busy hiding in an upstairs room. They weren't saying, "Yes, I could hardly wait till Sunday." They were scared they were going to be arrested and crucified themselves. The gospel is the gospel of surprise. And despite all of the passages from the Old Testament scriptures that anticipate the coming of a Messiah who would be a servant, slaughtered lamb, glorious king, a triumphant conqueror, and a bleeding sacrifice. Despite all the scriptures that talk along these lines, many of them using typology rather than mere verbal prediction to point in that direction, the truth of the matter is it wasn't by and large picked up. Which is why when Jesus walks with the two on the Emmaus Road after the resurrection, he can rebuke them and say, "Oh, fools and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have written." Ought not Christ to have suffered? Fact remains, it was a surprise. So when we come to this passage where Jesus demonstrates that he is himself the resurrection and the life, the passage is marked by surprise after surprise after surprise until we come to the greatest gospel surprise of all. Number one, Jesus hears a desperate plea for help and demonstrates his love by delay. Verses 1 to 16, we're introduced to Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. I love the description, Lord, the one you love is sick. Have you noticed this even in a church with a good pastor, that just about everybody in the church thinks they're the pastor's special friend? They feel loved. And that's true in larger familial relationships as well. One of the remarkable things about John's gospel is that the evangelist simply calls himself the one who Jesus loved. That does not mean, he loves me more than you. It's just that he feels so loved himself that that's the way he likes to designate himself, the one whom Jesus loved. And there are the sisters, referring to their brother Lazarus who is ill. Lord, the one you love is ill. Isn't it a wonderful thing? We should go around our relationships and our familial responsibilities and think of ourselves as the one whom Jesus loved. Isn't that what Paul prays for in Ephesians chapter 3? That you might have power, together with all the saints, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of God, to know this love that surpasses knowledge, so that you might be filled with all the measure of the fullness of God. In other words, that you might be mature. The implication is you can't be mature unless you experience for yourself more and more fully that you are loved by God. It's already being picked up in Jesus' personal earthly relationships. The one whom you love is sick. When he heard this, Jesus said, verse 4, this sickness will not end in death. Well, it won't end in death. It will go through death on the way. No, it is for God's glory. Not in order that God may receive glory, that's not the idea here, but that God's glory may be displayed. This is for the display of God's glory in displaying the glory of Christ as he raises him from the dead. That's why this man is so sick.
I love this message from Dr. D.A. Carson about the story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. But really, this is a story about Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, because Jesus cares for them. He calls them his friends. He loves them. He has a relationship with these three individuals. And because of that, Jesus chooses to wait. We see a similar story here in chapter 9 when Jesus heals the man who was born blind, and everyone around him, including his disciples, have this conclusion that this is a tragedy, and tragedy only befalls on a negative scenario, negative circumstance. So clearly this man or his parents must have sinned to be able to have such a tragedy in his life. But Jesus says, it's not for this reason, but so that through me, I can heal him and the glory of God will be revealed. This is a declaration of the gospel. And we see the same thing in this story, that he lingers, he waits just a little bit longer, knowing that that when he arrives, it will be too late in human terms, but an opportunity to proclaim that he is the resurrection and the life, to instill in them a spiritual truth that is far greater. You know, sometimes we look at the story of Jesus and God and we see such heartache and such pain and all of this. And in this experience, we can draw the conclusion that God must be cruel, that God must be angry with us, that God must be vindictive and judgmental. And the truth is that God actually cares for us, that he only chastens us because he wants us to understand what is right, what is wrong, and he wants us to trust in him. This is all about our good, and it's only a loving and caring Father who has an eternal perspective, who could ever be able to do what Jesus and what God does in these stories, to allow us to suffer. You and I, we don't do well with that. If we see somebody suffering, we want to step in and we want to intervene. We want to stop the suffering. But God knows that sometimes going through the valley of the shadow of death is necessary so that we can get to the other side, where there are still waters, where there are green pastures, and where there is peace. And that is what God wants us to do. He wants us to walk through those dark valleys so that we can reach something that is far better than what we're leaving behind. I hope that all of this encourages you, and if it has, I hope that you'll be an encouragement to us. Obviously, trials are no different for us than it is for you. We all face troubles, and we know how hard it is to make sacrifices for things that are eternal. But we believe in the ministry of Songtime and what we're striving to do to communicate the gospel on a daily basis. And we've made many sacrifices for this ministry, and I know that many of you have as well. But can I encourage you, if you have been blessed, would you consider giving back to the Songtime ministry with your donation? Write to us at Songtime Radio, P.O. Box 100, Barnstable, Massachusetts, 02630, or give us a call. It's 508-362-7070. That's 508-362-7070. You can also head over to our website at songtime.com or look us up on social media. But don't forget to tune in again tomorrow as we look again at how God likes to subvert our expectations so he can teach us to hope in that which is eternal.
And in waiting 2 days, he established such spectacular certainty of Lazarus's death that when he raised him from the dead, no one could say anything skeptical. Jesus demonstrates his love by delay.
On behalf of everyone here at Songtime, we want to thank you for listening. From Cape Cod, I'm Adam Miller with our theme verse, John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life.